Good evening, everybody. Okay,
the tape is on. Our topic tonight is Berlin Orthodoxy. Last week, we discussed Samson Raphael Hirsch, and if I gave a primarily negative assessment of his career, I didn't mean to, but we ran out of time, and I would have spent a few moments on his success as an educator, as a pedagogue, and as a builder of institutions. Samson Raphael Hirsch in Frankfurt at the IRG was successful in building primary and secondary day schools where there was a combination of Jewish and secular studies, the likes of which we have today in America, all over the country, modern Orthodox variety. But in Germany, that was a very uncommon thing. Even in other big Jewish communities that were even more prosperous, somehow the day school didn't get off the ground. Either they tried and failed, or it just never happened at all. And children who were members of Orthodox synagogues or separatist groups ended up having to rely upon supplemental education after the public school day was over. By American standards, that would be horribly insufficient. But yet in Germany of the 19th and early 20th century, that's all they could hope for in most cities, even in most Orthodox congregations. But Hirsch was a success story in this regard. He had primary and secondary schooling for both boys and girls. That's an important thing to emphasize, that he didn't leave out the girls. But what Hirsch did not do was to develop institutions of advanced learning for the training of rabbis. That would be the domain of Berlin Orthodoxy, in particular, Israel Hildesheimer. So let's tonight spend some time on Hildesheimer, then his successor, David Zvi Hoffman, and then just a general assessment of what Berlin Orthodoxy and German Orthodoxy, other than the Frankfurt group, was trying to accomplish. Okay. Just, so, yeah.
Just to sum up, because from last week, we prefaced this week. What would you say was his greatest contribution? What was his legacy?
His legacy was that he created a kehila that stood the test of time, multiple generations, and was even able to relocate itself on another continent because they were firm in their commitment to religious practice, to halakhic observance, and to doctrinal orthodoxy, a belief in revelation, an absolute doctrinal orthodoxy that was self-sufficient. It didn't have to rely upon outsiders. Now, that's not entirely true. His son-in-law who took over for him was a Hungarian rabbi, and eventually there'd be others who would take on the leadership mantle who came from the outside, but the point is, this was a Breuer, Solomon Breuer. But as a community, it could stand alone as a viable, all-encompassing Orthodox kehila. It took care of itself.
And didn't have this before, prior?
Well, what you didn't have before was a community of Jews who were culturally and economically integrated into society, who maintained religious observance levels that were compatible with the rudiments of halakha. Beforehand, you had pre-modern Jews who were religious. And simultaneous to Hirsch, you have modern Jews who are walking away from religious observance in droves. So his success is that he's able to retain the allegiance to tradition, to observance, of a nice chunk of people, a large number of people, in a very modern environment, which had not really happened before. Okay. So,
if you go to any good Jewish culture, you will find Hirschian thought has a substantial shelf.
Yes, Hirschian thought does have a substantial shelf. The 19 letters, Chorev, the Perish on the Chumash and the Tehillim, people still buy it. You'll still see it on the shelves. Now, I didn't mention much of that because in other circles that was looked down upon as less than scholarly, as unimpressive. To the lay people, it was good enough. To his lay people, it was the gospel. But to others, about whom we'll speak tonight, it was unimpressive.
That was the Torah Mada philosophy. That's behind YU.
Not exactly. YU is a world away. Although Amsterdam Avenue and Bennett Avenue are only 8/10 of a mile apart, they're 1,000 miles apart in some respects. Torim Derech Eretz and Torah Mada are not the same thing. I'd have to spend hours to try to explain the nuanced difference between the two. But suffice it to say that they're similar enough to not be too antagonistic.
Is the community, the broader community as it exists today, a reflection of what he did, or he has evolved in different ways?
It's 150 years later, so of course things will evolve. We're in a new country, a new continent, a new century. But is there anything of the spirit of the original Torahim Derech Eretz? I'm sure some people would say yes, but others would say no. And the no answer is closer to the truth.
Is there still a school in the Heights?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, so Ezriel Hildesheimer was born 1820 in Halberstadt to a rabbinical family. He studies in his youth under Yaakov Ettlinger and Altona, Isaac Bernays in Hamburg, the same teachers that Samson Raphael Hirsch had a few years earlier. He studies in the Gymnasia, goes to the University of Halle, gets his doctorate on the right interpretation of the Bible, a study of the Septuagint. He married a wealthy girl and was able to do whatever he wanted in his career without worry of Parnassa. In 1851, he became the rabbi of Eisenstadt in Hungary, which is today in Austria, but then it was Hungary. And from 1851 to 1869, he has a career in the Hungarian rabbinate as a communal rav, but also as the head of a yeshiva. Now, his yeshiva was different from the other yeshivas in that it had secular studies, which, of course, was anathema to the right-wingers, and even maybe to the centrists among the Hungarian Orthodox. And so they had their problems with Hildesheimer. But Hildesheimer was a success story there. He attracted students from all over the world, certainly all over Europe, and had hundreds at one point. So people are flocking to his academy where they can get their Talmudic training and also have secular knowledge. Next week, we'll discuss at length his involvement in the affairs of Hungarian Jewry, especially of the 1860s. But tonight I want to focus on Germany, so we're going to ignore his 2 decades in the Hungarian rabbinate. Suffice it to say that in 1867, the Berlin community, the Berlin Orthodox, who were not happy with the non-traditional rabbi there, which was first Geiger, then Aub, they wanted an impressive Orthodox rabbi to lead a separatist congregation. And so in 1869, he moves and becomes the rabbi of Adas Yisrael in Berlin, which was a secessionist Orthodox synagogue of 200 families at first. He was happy to get out of Hungary and to go to Berlin for a few reasons. One, the situation in Hungary was a disaster. In 1868-1869, there was the Hungarian Jewish Congress, which we'll speak about at length, in which the Orthodox and the Neolog, which is the moderate reform, were duking it out for control of the Jewish communal life. The Orthodox themselves were divided between right, left, and center, but the major fissure was between the Orthodox and the non-Orthodox, the Neolog. And the goal of maintaining Jewish unity, sadly, failed. It was, as Jacob Katz calls it, Hakera Shalonit Acha, the breach that was never healed, the divided house. That the Hungarian Jewry was too feisty for its own good, and the Neolog and the Orthodox could not get along. Hildesheimer realized he couldn't accomplish much there because of the extremist nature of Jewish politics. He wanted out, he goes to Germany. In Germany, what does he want to accomplish there? Yes, he's a communal rabbi for the Orthodox in Berlin, but he mainly wants to have a yeshiva, but not just any old yeshiva. He wants to develop a modern rabbinical seminary which is of an Orthodox variety. Now, there are rabbinical seminaries already in existence. In 1854, at Breslau, you have the Positive Historical Seminary, the Jewish Theological Seminary under Frankel. And then in 1872, you have the Hochschule, which is the liberal or the reform one under Geiger. So in 1872, Hildesheimer sends out missives all around Germany to all the Orthodox machers and important rabbinical figures, saying we need to create this seminary in Berlin, but it shouldn't just be a Berlin affair. It should be an institution supported by and cared for by the broader German Orthodoxy. He had reason to suspect that this effort would be well-funded and well-supported by the key players within German Orthodoxy. He was sadly disappointed when it turned out that the two other leading Orthodox rabbis in the country were against the seminary idea, each for his own reason, although related reasons. So who are they? The leading rabbinical scholar in Germany was the Würzburger Rav, Selgman Bear Bamberger, Yitzchak Dov Bamberger, the Rav in southern Germany in Bavaria, in Würzburg. And he was not a modern character. He believed that a rabbi only needed to have a minimal amount of Bildung, of culture, enough to get by, but that a rabbi did not need to be a Western cultured person. Now, Hirsch, of course, felt otherwise, and even Hildesheimer felt otherwise. But in southern Germany, in Bavarian Orthodoxy, it was still an old world style religion. They didn't think the rabbi should be a modernisher guy. Okay, so what's wrong with a seminary? Because the rabbi doesn't need to focus on university studies, which would be a corollary to his studies in the seminary. And so there's a suspicion that this is not the way to go. Hirsch in Frankfurt also opposes the seminary, and he has his son do his dirty work for him. His son, writing in the Yeshurun publication, which was the Frankfurt monthly journal, put out an open letter to Hildesheimer, asking Hildesheimer to clarify the tendency of the new seminary. In other words, prove to us that you're really Orthodox. Now, bear in mind that in 1854, Hirsch had done the same thing to Frankl. He said, what is the tendency of your school? Are you really a traditional school? Prove to us, you know, what are you going to do over there? And what did Frankl respond to Hirsch? Nothing. He didn't respond. He didn't dignify it with a response. So Hildesheimer, too, was offended that here he has his credentials. He's been a stream Orthodox figure for multiple decades, and Hirsch's son is questioning the Orthodox bona fides of this new institution. Not nice, not nice. And it led to a certain ill will between the two camps for a while. Okay. But the other reason why Hirsch opposes the seminary is because the rabbinical seminary is going to focus on Wissenschaft des Judentum, the scientific study of Judaism. It's going to be a yeshiva in the sense that, yes, the boys are going to study Talmud and Halacha and Shulchan Aruch, but they're also going to study graduate school-style academic Jewish studies for the purpose of refuting the Reformers and the Gentile anti-Semites who would try to undermine the legitimacy of Judaism using documentary hypothesis, biblical criticism, criticism of the Talmud, that the academic Jewish studies in this institution will be a means of defending Orthodoxy from its detractors, whether Jew or Gentile. To an extent, yes. As an alum of that school, I can tell you that an element of the Revel curriculum goes a long way in defending Orthodoxy. So, that's the objection. What actually happens? The school opens in 1873, in the fall, and Hildesheimer gives his introductory remarks, and it's clear that this is an Orthodox institution, because the name of the school is the Rabbiner Seminar für das Orthodox Judentum. By 1880, they would take out the Orthodox part and just make it the Berlin Rabbiner Seminar. But at least in its first decade, the denominational character of the school was in the name and very, very clear.
What was the enrollment? Is there any figure on that?
Yeah, we do have. So the enrollment at first was 20 students, and the high point was 58 students in 1895. Now, that might not sound like a lot, but actually it is, because it's not a yeshiva that's geared towards the masses, where L'shem Shemayim, everyone is coming to learn Torah. No, this is a preparation for the rabbinate. And so there are only X number of positions available, only X number of people looking to study for the Western European Orthodox rabbinate. To have 58 at any one time is actually a fairly large number. Okay. The tuition was negligible, and in fact they subsidized a lot of students, especially the Eastern Europeans who had nothing, not a penny to their names. Okay. The hours of instruction. Well, it was a 7-year course of study, simultaneous with enrollment at the University of Berlin. More than half of the hours of study were devoted to Talmud and Halacha. The other hours were devoted to ancillary subjects like Bible, Hebrew, and later on Jewish history and Jewish philosophy. No, this is not an Eastern European Musar yeshiva. This is a Central European seminary. But that's not to say that it was all rigorous academics all the time. It was rigorous academics, but there was a certain close-knit feeling between the faculty and the students. There was an emotional component to the whole thing, and it was necessary. Why was it necessary? Because when you're studying in the University of Berlin, and you're studying academic Jewish studies, there is the distinct possibility that a person might have the light bulb go off and decide they're no longer Orthodox. In other words, they've learned too much. Now they've seen the light, and they no longer are traditional believers. That they buy into the academic criticism of the Bible that they learned in the academy, in the university. So students had real questions. Early on, there was no philosophy department at the rabbinical seminary. Only later, when Joseph Wolgemuth joined the faculty, did they have a philosophy department. So in the beginning, there was nothing countering secular philosophy. There was just Talmud study and halakhic studies. So it was really necessary for the professors to develop this really close relationship with their disciples and be able to give the pat on the shoulder or the comforting, soothing answer to the serious questions about religious doubt that some of them might have had. Now, the seminary was very proud of itself in 1885, 12 years after it opened, that in that time only one of its disciples had gone astray, had left Orthodoxy, and had taken a pulpit with an organ. That's not to say that everyone who passed through the doors of the seminary retained their Orthodox beliefs. It's just that people who had questions likely didn't finish their course of study there. They walked away at some point. They didn't continue matriculating. We know this to be the case, that certain people were there for a year or two, but then decided to go on a different direction in life. We also know that even though there were very few, very, very few rabbis who were congregational rabbis who graduated from this seminary who went to non-Orthodox pulpits, there were plenty of, or at least a significant number of, graduates who, although not congregational rabbis, in other capacities departed from Orthodoxy, whether they were public intellectuals or professors of Judaic studies in non-Orthodox seminaries. The one who comes to mind is Jacob Lauterbach, who was an illustrious graduate of the Berlin Seminary, but went on to be a professor at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati and write Reform Responsa. So these things did happen. You have people who graduated from Hildesheimer's Academy, but they did other things in life beyond the outer limits of Orthodoxy. But from the congregational rabbinate point of view, they typically toed the line. Now, Lauterbach graduated from Hildesheimer, came to America, and became a professor in Cincinnati.
I mean, I think that everybody should realize that Jacob Lauterbach was he was really the founder of American Reform. He was their posek.
He was their posek, and then after him was Solomon Frihoff. Yeah. Right, he invented Reform Psak Halacha.
And their books are still on the shelf.
Yeah, they're good books.
Right next to Rabbi...
So... The reason why rabbis who served in the field tended not to depart from Orthodoxy if they had graduated from Hildesheimer's school was that at least after 1884, there was a codicil to the Smicha document. It was a Hoda'a Ne'emana that said, if the bearer of this document takes a pulpit where there's an organ or a reformed liturgy or no machitza, this semicha document is hereby rescinded. So you automatically lost your ordination as a rabbi if you went into a type of congregation that was contrary to the halacha as understood by Berlin Orthodoxy.
Wait a second, you said no mechitza?
Yeah.
You said, I thought that just in the nature of the architecture, men and women sat separately no matter what.
That's true. But let's say the guy went to America where there were congregations with mixed seating. So this is the sort of thing that would get you in trouble. Okay.
To be noted, hey, I'm sorry for interrupting, but in the United States, only one major smicha giving institution did that.
Ah.
And that was RJJ.
RJJ, yeah.
Not even Rav. Nobody.
Nobody did that.
Sended a smicha of anybody that skipped ship.
Uh-huh.
I know people who skipped ship and went to the conservative reform movement from those smichas, and they were never rescinded. Only RJJ publicly rescinded a smicha from anybody.
Okay. Now, in the Eastern European students who came to the Hildesheimer Academy in Berlin thought that by coming to Berlin, they were going to learn about the wider world. You come from Vilna, from Bialystok, from Volozhin, from Zhytomyr, wherever you come to Berlin thinking that you're going to be exposed to great culture, a more cosmopolitan existence than the parochial one of Eastern Europe. But what did these students end up finding? That the world of Berlin Orthodoxy didn't go past the walls of the building. That really they were part of an institution that was an enclave in a cosmopolitan city, but had nothing to do with the rest of that city. The detractors of Hildesheimer's seminary, meaning those who were from the Hochschule, which was literally next door, down the block, on the same street, said, yes, Hildesheimer's seminary is on Hipstrasse in Berlin, but it's not really in Berlin. It's in a universe unto itself. That they did not integrate.
All yeshivas are like that.
I don't know about all yeshivas, but that was the criticism. And from an Eastern European student's point of view, not only did they not get the wider world they were hoping for, but the Talmudic study they were hoping to get was inferior compared to that which they were accustomed to in the traditional yeshivas of Poland and Lithuania. So in fact, they got nothing.
But they did have exposure to the university.
Correct. So it wasn't a complete waste of time. However, it wasn't as productive as they might have wanted it to be. Now, for this very reason, a fellow like Louis Ginzburg, who was a Gaon Olam, was a genius, a child prodigy, an Elui, and from the family of the Vilna Gaon, he was born in 1873 and studied in the Cheder, and rose through the ranks. And then in the late 1880s, as a teenager, he was going to go off to Central Europe. But he thought about going to the Hildesheimer Academy. But he realized there's nothing for him there. That already at the age of 16, he was well above and beyond the Talmudic proficiency as even the professors were at the Hildesheimer Yeshiva. So he didn't bother. He just went to university and went on his own way. Now, despite that fact, Ginzburg wrote a glowing review of David Zvi Hoffman's career when Hoffman died in 1921. Hoffman was the successor to Hildesheimer and was a devout Jew and a practitioner of the scientific study of Judaism. So Ginzburg, although he didn't study under the guy, said this man was a great figure, a heroic figure in Judaism. I just give that as an example of sometimes...
Ginzburg himself evolved into a towering scholar in the States at the seminary.
Yes, he was the biggest Talmudic scholar of the first half of the 20th century.
Was he the author of The Legends of the Jews?
Author of Legends of the Jews, correct. Okay.
And he had a friendship with Henrietta Zold.
And with Henrietta Zold, correct. All right. Now, when it came to the Wissenschaft des Judentum, the scientific study of Judaism, this was not typically an orthodox endeavor. When it was founded in the 1820s, it was founded by Jews who basically were tired of old-fashioned rabbinic Judaism and were hoping to give Judaism a decent burial. In other words, let's study what was in a sophisticated academic way, in a critical way, and to show that Judaism should be part of the canon of Western literature, but that practical Judaism, the living Judaism, is basically dead. Then, Wissenschaft des Judentum was the domain of the Reform rabbis. In the eyes of Samson Raphael Hirsch, it was just a convenient cover for radical reform. So we wouldn't associate this academic course of study with Orthodox rabbis. And yet, at Hildesheimer's academy, at his seminary, there it was. Well, what was it doing there? The answer is, you can use the tools of modern science, of modern scholarship, possibly to defend that which is under assault. Of course, you run the risk, if you don't restrain yourself, if you don't have certain red lines that you won't cross, into yourself becoming overly exposed to the enemy's criticisms of Judaism and adopting them wholeheartedly. So the scientific study of Judaism from a traditional Jew's point of view is a dangerous gamble. A dangerous gamble. Okay. Hirsch criticized Gretz, Heinrich Gretz, for being insufficiently scientific. That Gretz had an agenda. Just as Gretz criticized Geiger for having an agenda. Everybody criticizes somebody else, claiming you are using the cover of scientific study to pursue a theological or ideological agenda that is not really supported by the facts. Everybody accuses somebody else of doing the same aveira, the same sin. And you know what? They're all right. Because everybody's guilty. Everyone has their own ideological agenda, and they're using the cover of science to prove a point. Were there any people out there who studied Judaism scientifically, l'shem shamayim, you might say, just for its own sake, not to change the religion? The answer is yes. But those were few and far between, and in modern times, they're professors at the University of Indiana or the University of California at Santa Clara. You know, some random place where they're not. It's not a religious seminary. It's a university, and they study the past for the sake of studying the past. But in the 19th century, that didn't exist. You didn't have professorships in secular universities where a guy was studying Talmud for the sake of studying an old book. Everybody who did it had an agenda, had an axe to grind, and they're trying to prove the other guy's wrong. Okay. Leopold Zuntz.
He was an honest person.
So Leopold Zuntz had an agenda in the beginning. He was the preacher at the Hamburg, at the Berlin Temple. Okay, later he went away from that. In the last 50 years of his career, he was, as you might say, l'shem shamayim. It was just study for the sake of studying without a religious agenda. But in the beginning, no, absolutely not. Absolutely not. He said any mitzvah that he did was a concession to the stirrings of the soul. Okay. All right. Now, Hirsch and Hildesheimer had very different viewpoints about education. Hirsch believed in the wedding, the melding of general knowledge and Torah. He really was Torah im derech eretz, put the two together. But no scientific study. Hildesheimer was general knowledge is good. Torah is even more important. And general knowledge is just a handmaiden to our knowledge of Torah. But scientific study is good. So there's a certain irony here. Who's more frum than the other? Each one in his own way. Because saying that you can put together general culture, general knowledge, and Torah is a very progressive idea. Opposing academic study is a very not-so-progressive idea, reactionary idea. Hildesheimer is the opposite. Academic study is wonderful, progressive idea. General culture, a handmaiden to Torah, not so progressive idea. Each one has his own theory. But what does Hirsch say about those who engage in the scientific study? He says they're missing the boat. That living Judaism is the main thing. Living, breathing Judaism is what we want. Not just the study of the past by antiquarians. And he said that the antiquarian knows what Rashi ate for breakfast on the 13th of Nisan in the year 1084. But the Frum, they know Rashi. Why? Because they read Rashi's commentary day after day, every day of their lives. So the antiquarian knows what Rashi ate for breakfast, but the Frum know Rashi. How do you like that? It's a good point. It's a good point that sometimes the traditional method of study and the traditional attitude towards Judaism has a greater appreciation of what the old sages of 1,000 years ago intended, whereas the antiquarian knows the minutiae, the details of who the guy married and what year this and year that, things that don't really make any difference to anyone. Except to me, because I like this stuff. Okay. All right. Hirsch had an odd relationship with David Zvi Hoffman. Hoffman was born in 1843 in Slovakia and studied in the Pressburg Yeshiva under the Ksav Sofer, the son of the Chasim Sofer, studied under the Maharam Shik, Rav Moshe Shik, and then he studied also in his youth under Hildesheimer and Eisenstadt in the yeshiva that had secular studies. After he finished his studies on the yeshiva and was ordained, he went for academic training in the universities of Vienna, Berlin, and Tübingen. He wrote his doctoral dissertation on Shmuel. Who is Shmuel?
102.
Huh?
102.
Who is Shmuel?
The Amora.
The Amora, correct. Not the Navi, the Amora. So the title of his dissertation was Mar Samuel, Mar Shmuel. Shmuel was, together with Rav, the first generation of Babylonian Amoraim, and is one of the key figures in the Babylonian Talmud. Without Shmuel, you don't have the Babylonian Talmud. Okay? And in that dissertation, Hoffman spoke about laws being invented in the Amoraic period, legal theories being propagated anew in the Amoraic period, having no precedent in the Tannaitic period, and the history of the oral tradition as not exactly reported in the traditional sources. So Hirsch did not like Hoffman's dissertation, and he tried to suppress its publication. He pulled out all the stops to prevent that book from seeing the light of day. Ultimately, Hoffman published it anyway. And Hoffman went on to become a professor of Shulchan Aruch, of Poskim, in the Hildesheimer Seminary. But the odd thing about it is that Hoffman worked for Hirsch for 3 years in Frankfurt, in his high school, as a teacher of Talmud. So here, you have an employee who's leaving your school to go to the other team, and you try to suppress his work on the grounds that it's quasi-heretical, but meanwhile you employed him for the last 3 years and you knew what he wrote. So it was an odd, very odd relationship. But Hoffman was a great scholar, a much greater scholar than Hirsch ever was. Hirsch was good for bourgeois balabatim, whose level of Judaic sophistication was minimal. By contrast, Hoffman was a great Talmud Chacham, and in Berlin, you couldn't get away with the certain things you could get away with in Frankfurt. It's like certain things don't fly west, you know, only west of the Hudson. I mean, I remember there was a certain rabbi who gave a drasha for the high holidays in a certain shul that I used to go to, and with a certain Midwestern accent, and someone said that only flies west of the Hudson, because it was not substantive. That was the criticism that the Berliners had of Hirsch. And in Hoffman, they found someone of great tochen, of great content. Okay.
In a literary sense, how far did Hoffman go compared to Hirsch?
What do you mean, the literary sense?
In the book, in the stuff that he put out that survives his physical...
Oh, sure. Hoffman put out many, many important things. Number one, yes, Das Buch Leviticus, the book Leviticus, which was translated into Hebrew in the 1920s. Das Buch Deuteronomy, which is translated from the German into the Hebrew, he put out Shalos Tshuvos, Melamed Lahoil, 4 volumes. He was the posek of German Orthodoxy from the death of Hildesheimer until his own death in 1921. Without a doubt, he was the leading posek of German Orthodoxy. He put out plenty of material of top notch quality. Okay, so the critics of the Berlin Seminary said, well, we can't trust the orthodoxy of these folks. No? Why not? Well, because Hoffman was writing about Shmuel, and he wrote about the new laws and the new theories of law, and other professors at the seminary also did controversial things. who did what? Jacob Barth was the professor of Bible. You never heard of his name, probably. So Jacob Barth was Hildesheimer's son-in-law, and was the professor of Bible, and he made a veiled reference to Deutero-Isaiah. What's Deutero-Isaiah? Eigewalt. So chapters 40 through 66 of Isaiah are, according to the academicians, not written by the same Isaiah who was a prophet in the 8th century BCE, but rather by a post-exilic author. The evidence is pretty compelling, and Bizman Hazeh, nowadays, for an Orthodox rabbi to say that is not so controversial. I've said it from this pulpit a bunch of times and gotten away with it. Okay, so it's really not so controversial today. But at that time, it was. So people say, well, how can we trust the orthodoxy of this school if their professors are saying things that are not so kosher? Worse yet, the professors of the rabbinical seminary, Hildesheimer School, also collaborated on occasion with professors from the Hochschule, from the liberal school. Now, if you're a traditional Jew of the Frankfurt sort or of the Bavarian sort, are you going to pal around with professors at a Reform seminary? No, they're happy korsim gemurim. They should be stoned to death, you know, in theory, you would say. But yet these people are fraternizing. Unacceptable, unacceptable. All right. So, in fact, was there a problem with the orthodoxy in the school? Not at all. The professors were all very, very committed to the doctrine. What is the doctrine? What is the doctrine they're committed to? Okay, what else? Flesh it out a little bit more. Not just Tormina Shemayim. The oral law. Okay, so the main thing is that the oral law is is part of the divine revelation and is not something that is just evolving over time. Who would say that the oral law evolved over time? Well, the reformers would say that, but even the middle of the road folks would say that. Guys like Frankl, who, if you remember when we discussed Frankl, he never said in his book that the oral law was mina shamayim, and they caught him on that. They wouldn't stop. They pressured him, you know, say it, and he wouldn't say it. Why not? We're not going to get into now. But the point is, for the Orthodox professors, they are openly stating their belief in the Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh being mina shamayim. That is the key thing that maintains, that makes them Orthodox, aside from any level of halachic observance. Okay. In 1895, Isaac Halevi comes on the scene in Germany. Who is Isaac Halevi? He's a Lithuanian Talmudist who is a self-taught historian of the oral law. And he writes a work called Doros HaRishonim. Doros HaRishonim, the early generations. He was regarded as a hero in certain Orthodox circles because finally there was someone who represented Orthodox Wissenschaft. Orthodox scholarly studies, historical studies. What was he trying to prove? Doros HaRishonim was coming to undo all the anti-traditional remarks that were made in Gretz's History of the Jews and in Isaac Hirsch Weiss's Dor Dor V'Dor Shav, another five-volume history of the oral law. So all these fellows who were middle-of-the-roaders, who were non-Orthodox, who wrote their histories of the oral law, did not conform to the teachings of the Talmud about the origins of the oral law. And comes along Isaac HaLevi to say, no, I reread the sources, and this is what really happened. And towing the party line. The Frankfurt Orthodox actually greatly appreciated Isaac HaLevi and Doros HaRishonim, because it proved that all the non-Orthodox fellows were in over their heads. They didn't know what they were talking about. The problem with Doros HaRishonim and why the Berlin crowd didn't really like it was sloppy work. It was too apologetic. It was too much too polemical. He was breathing fire against all the non-Orthodox and he's calling them names. You can't do that. You have to have a certain decorum and menschlichkeit when you discuss historical scholarship. You can't just breathe fire against those who you disagree with. And ultimately, Doros HaRishonim, nobody reads it today. Why? Because the scholars of the university consider it to be unimportant, junk, and the Orthodox aren't interested in history. And most of the Orthodox lay people who might be interested in history can't read the Doros HaRishonim because their level of competence in reading primary text is not there. So in German households, they used to buy it on the shelf, and it would sit on the shelf. like a shas in a lot of homes. You know, it sits on the shelf and nobody touches it. So the Doros Rishonim, it sat on the shelf and nobody touched it. Because nobody who was willing to buy it was able to read it. And those who could read it didn't want to buy it because they thought it was nonsense. Okay. One of the problems that the Orthodox of Southern Germany had with the Berlin Seminary was they found it distasteful for a guy like Hildesheimer or Hoffman, but especially Hoffman, to mention Rashi and the Rashbam in the same breath that he mentions Wellhausen and Delitzsch. In other words, you're mentioning Mefarshim, classical Mefarshim that appear in the Chumash, in the same breath as Gentile Bible scholars who were antagonistic to Judaism. It doesn't go over well. If you would go to an Aguda shul and start quoting Wellhausen, they'd throw you off the stage. They wouldn't know who he was today. But at a time when people were more aware of criticism of the Bible, and Central Europe in the 19th century, late 19th century, that's everybody knows. Even the most parochial of Jews in Germany knows these things. Okay, so Hertz is guilty of the same Avera. If you go to the back of the Hertz Chumash, there's a roster of names of traditional commentaries, non-traditional Jewish commentaries, and then Gentile commentators. And it's all mixed on every page of the Hertz Chumash.
He was fighting
against a lot of forces in England in the 1920s and 30s. Yeah, and he did a great job of it. He did an excellent job. The Hertz Chumash is the King James Bible of the Jews. Okay, you heard it here. Yeah. But he did an excellent job. But you could understand why...
For his time.
But you understand why those who were not of that mentality would be personally offended by a rabbi who's a professor of Talmud or Halacha throwing around names of traditional Mefarshim and Apikorsim or Shkatzim in the same sentence. It doesn't go over well. Okay, in America it wasn't a problem, but my point is that in Germany in the mid to late 19th century, not everyone was a modern Jew. They were still sort of pre-modern Jews in some kihilot in the south.
So
yeah.
It's Berlin against whom?
So it's Berlin against Frankfurt primarily, but it's really also Berlin against everyone else, because among the Orthodox, they were the only ones who were so progressive when it came to the style of learning, the willingness to engage in Wissenschaft, and the openness to academic studies.
All over Europe.
Was there influence? Did the Hildesheimer Academy have influence around Europe? The answer is yes. Many pulpits in France, in England, all over Germany, Belgium, okay, were occupied by graduates of the Hildesheimer Seminary. Even in America there were graduates. Okay? Leo Jung, Jewish Center, was from Hildesheimer. Right.
Did Ginsberg also use secular sources?
Of course, yeah.
This was the MO of those days.
But if you take a look today, look at all these weekly Jewish papers.
Yeah.
You'll never see in any Parsha of the Week or anything like that a quote of a secular commentator.
Unless Jonathan Sachs does it.
Unless Evan Hoffman does it in his Thoughts of the Parsha.
That's also true, but you're not going to see that published in the papers.
No.
Okay. Now, one more topic I want to cover tonight, which is very, very important in my view of things. A problem that the Orthodox had in the 19th century is a problem that rabbis had dating back to the times of the Rishonim. And that is the drashot, the exegetical interpretations of the Talmud, that the Talmud has of the Bible, and from which we seem to derive halakha, are often very far-fetched and not very compelling. Sometimes they are downright absurd. And the methods of interpretation, the midot shatara nidreshet bahen, are sometimes not very logical. So, what do we do about that? Even in the Rishonim, in the days of Rishonim, people were bothered by these questions. The basic question is, menah hanimili, how do we know this? How do we know that the halakha is such? And the answer is, we quote a pasuk. We quote a verse from the Bible. But does that verse from the Bible really say what the halakha is? No, it's a very tenuous connection, and you have to do contortions to make it say what the claim is that it says. So, in the Rishonic times, the basic machlokus was between the Ramban and the Rambam, that the Rambam says the bulk of the halakha is Sinaitic revelation of the oral law, and that the drashot are mostly asmachtot, are just mnemonic devices, and that we don't really learn the halakha from the drasha, that the halakha was already known, and that the verse in Torah, which is used to support that halakha, is just a mere support, but not the basis for the halakha. Whereas the Ramban would say, no, that the halakha is derived from exegetical interpretation, not from a previously known oral tradition, and so the sages are engaged in creative interpretation. They are actively involved in the legislative process that is the halakha.
That's the truth.
Whether it's the truth or it's not the truth is for people to debate for thousands of years. My point is, in the 19th century, what's going on? So 19th century, this is a real issue, because the reformers were sensitive to these criticisms that the Gentiles had of Judaism, of Rabbinic Judaism. That Rabbinic Judaism is based upon all these fanciful drashot that have no basis in the plain reading of the text. Okay? And so the reformers acknowledged, yeah, you know what? You're right. It's fanciful interpretation. It's not the plain meaning. And that Judaism evolved over time. And that we have to undo some of the errors of the past by reforming Judaism. Now, that's a very radical approach, and it leads to doing away with whole chunks of practical Judaism.
Was this a question of intrinsic belief, or was it an apology toward the non-Jews?
I think it was a little bit of both, but I don't doubt for a second that it's intrinsic belief, that the reformers were embarrassed by the dialectics of the Talmud, and they said, this doesn't make any sense, this is illogical. And so what do we do about it? We come back to some more mosaic-type religion, and the minutiae of the halakha are simply ignored, or we outright abrogated. But from an Orthodox point of view, what are you going to say? How do you defend tradition when the tradition has these challenges, these troubling points? Well, I'll give you four figures in German Orthodoxy who each tried to answer these questions. The first one is Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, who was born 1785, dies in 1865, and was a Rav in Königsberg. And he wrote Haktava HaKabbalah, Haksava HaKabbalah. Some people actually study this to this day. Huh?
80
years. He lived to be 80. 1785 to 1865. So his goal was to unify the written and the oral Torah. And he said that the proper understanding of Pshat is the profound meaning, and the profound meaning will correspond to the teachings of the oral law. So you don't have two corpora, but rather one corpus. There is no written law and oral law. There's one Torah. Okay, the notion of the dual Torah was like a misnomer as far as he's concerned. There's one Torah, like a body and soul united in a person. Everything regarded as d'oraita, of biblical level in halakha, was part of an original oral transmission to Moses at Mount Sinai, and that the Bible is intentionally ambiguous as a testament to the divine legislator who encoded many things into the text. So we can read things into the text if we're good at deciphering it, but it was all part of one massive revelation at the beginning.
Is that halacha Moshe Mitzrayim?
So you could claim that Halacha L'Moshe Mitzrayim is an element of the bigger revelation, but Halacha L'Moshe Mitzrayim has a specific definition, and that is halachot which are not found in the Torah, meaning things for which we do not find a peg, a hook, in the biblical text, but which stand alone completely and are not a drasha. Halacha L'Moshe Mitzrayim is few and far, they're few and far between, and they have no peg within the text of the Torah.
Oh, and this has a peg.
That's what he's saying. Okay, and he says the rabbis are not innovators of the law. They are working as exegetes within an already limited framework. Now, this is very nice. It says that the rabbis didn't invent Judaism, that God invented Judaism. But what's the problem with it? The problem is that every page of the Talmud goes against this. Every page of the Talmud has a very vigorous give and take of this rabbi debating this rabbi and debating this rabbi over interpretations of the text of Torah as it affects the halacha. But if the halacha was already known from a big, massive revelation, and the text of the Torah is just hooks for support for any given halacha, would the rabbis have been so feisty in their debates?
No.
The plain reading of the Talmud is that the rabbis were actually debating the halacha itself, not just the scriptural basis for an existing and universally recognized halacha. Okay.
Can't you say it was forgotten, and therefore they're arguing to come to a
conclusion? So there are those who make that point, in the 20th century Orthodox world, that was a very commonly espoused theory, but it doesn't really hold water, in my opinion. Now, the second theory was that of the Malbim. Meir Leibish Malbim, born in 1809, died in 1879, had a bit of an odd career. He was an Eastern Europeaner who moved to Germany. He was the Rav in Kempfen for a while. He wrote HaTorah V'HaMitzvah. Now, the Malbim is a popular commentator on certain books of the Bible, like the Megillus, he's very popular. But he wrote HaTorah V'HaMitzvah as a commentary not on the Torah, but on the Halachic Midrashim, the Malbim. The Halachic Midrashim, he wrote a commentary. And what he said was that the reformers think they know what the pshat is, but they're dead wrong. They have a superficial understanding of the pshat. The real pshat is closer to the drash, the exegetical drash halacha that appears in the Tannaitic literature. And it's not haphazard, and it's not illogical. Rather, it follows a system of rules. And how many rules are there?
13.
Wrong. 613. Okay, close. So Rabbi Yishmael had 13, he had 613. What are the nature of these rules? 248 for usage and 365 for verbs and synonyms. I've tried to read this, the Torah V'HaMitzvah, and it's in the introduction to his commentary on Vayikra, on Sifra, and I couldn't get past the first page. I tried my best, I just can't read it. All right.
This is the Malbim,
yeah.
And do you know what he almost became in his career towards the end of his life?
What was that?
Chief Rabbi of New York City. Of New York City.
Yeah. There was an attempt to bring him over.
Yeah, he died.
He died, yeah. And so instead they got Jacob Joseph 10 years later.
That was many years later.
About 10 years later. Okay. Now, the next person who we have to examine their theory is Hirsch. What did Hirsch say about all these things? How does Hirsch solve the problem of the illogical nature or the haphazard or the ad hoc nature of the drashot in the Talmud? So Hirsch had an unbelievable opinion on this. Unbelievable. What Hirsch said was, not that the oral law is a supplement to the written law. Everybody always said the oral law is a supplement to the written law. No. He said the written law is a supplement to the oral law. That what? There's this massive revelation by God to Moses on Mount Sinai, and that the Torah, the Shebichtav, is just notes that allow the student something to work with, like the cliff notes on the bigger revelation. That is the Torah Shebichtav. But the bigger revelation is much more all-encompassing, and that's the Torah Shebaal Peh. It's a nice theory, but really, Hirsch was not answering the question of how do we know this? Because after all, he was not an academician, he was not involved in biblical criticism, he was a rav of a separatist Orthodox kahila. He didn't have to answer how do we know this. He had to answer a different question. And that was, why do we still do this? Meaning, why do we observe Judaism? Not how do we know the halacha is from a certain year in antiquity, but rather, why does anyone still keep traditional Judaism? And what is his answer? His answer is, because God commanded it. And it's good for us. It's for our own betterment. So he has a theory to explain the relationship of the drashot to the Torah, but it's not important. The main thing is, why do we do this? God commanded it. Okay.
Our fathers did it.
Huh?
Because our fathers did it.
So Hirsch wouldn't like that answer. You know why not? Because the Our Fathers Did It answer is a very middle-of-the-road answer, a positive historical answer. Why does Frankl keep mitzvahs? forget Frankel per se, but why does the Breslau school say you should keep Judaism? Because your father did it, and his father, and his father, and his father, dating back a long time. How long? I couldn't tell you exactly, but a long time. And history and antiquity make something holy, therefore worthy of being preserved. So the Our Fathers Did It answer is compelling for some people, but it's not an orthodox answer, because it's not a doctrinal answer. It's a sociological answer, or anthropological answer. Yeah, okay. Now, the last one is Hoffman. What does Hoffman say about all this stuff? So he was younger than all the others by a generation at least. And he had to deal not only with questions about rabbinic exegesis, but also about biblical criticism in general, emanating not only from the Reform, but from the Gentiles. So what would he say? Whenever Wellhausen would claim that the Bible's voice shifts and represents a different author within the documentary view of the Bible, Hoffman would say, no, that's not a different author with a different voice, but rather it's the divine legislator indicating that we should shift our focus to a different aspect of the oral tradition, so that the multivalent character of the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, is indicative of different aspects of the Torah Sheba'al Peh. Okay, that was his theory. Now, what did he do in terms of the question of either Drashot creating laws or just mnemonic devices for existing laws? He held they were mnemonic devices, that all the halachot were derived from Moses on Mount Sinai, not created by the rabbis of the Talmudic period through their interpretations. So Judaism is as old as the hills, in his view. All right, but not only that, he does something also very important. Even if Judaism were as old as the year Gimel, and that God gave everything to the Jews in Mount Sinai, still, the Drashot are unimpressive, many of them. They're fantastical. They're not logical. So what does Hoffman do? He says, you're wrong. Half of them are logical. In what sense? That there was two schools of thought. There was the Academy of Rabbi Akiva and the Academy of Rabbi Yishmael. That Rabbi Akiva's academy had fantastical drashot, all sorts of crazy whims to interpret the Torah. But that the school of Yishmael was conservative, lowercase c. It was restrained, rational, logical, and that they never have drashot that are off a wall crazy. And he identified specific books within the halakhic midrashim that were from this school of Akiva as opposed to that school of Yishmael. He wasn't always right. And 100 years later, we can say that a lot of his scholarship has been undone. Not debunked, but it has evolved so that he wasn't entirely correct on everything. But he led everyone on a good path. This idea of Akiva versus Yishmael stood the test of time. Which author, whom I've discussed many, many times, wrote a 1,000-page book about that?
Yes, sir.
Heschel, Abraham Joshua Heschel's Torah Min HaShemayim, as translated into English by Gordon Tucker, is a massive volume of showing the theological differences between the wild Rabbi Akiva and the tame Rabbi Yishmael. So I like it a lot, even though there are areas where Heschel sort of fudge the difference between the two. It's not always so rigorous. I like it. It's a tremendous work, and it's worth buying the English version. You can't buy the Hebrew. It's out of print. They only printed like a limited number of copies. You can't find it anywhere. If you want to buy it, it's thousands of dollars on eBay. But the English, they sell it in Barnes & Noble. Buy it. It's worth reading. Huh?
I bought it, but I didn't read it.
You didn't read it. Okay.
It's on
the shelf. Okay. So, now, the last 2 minutes we have, let's compare the modern Orthodox of Germany and the Lithuanian Jews when it comes to this issue of creativity in the halacha. So, in the Lithuanian schools of the Vilna Gaon, the Nitziv, they believed, like the Ramban, and not like the Germans, that the rabbis of the Talmud created halachot. That when they expounded upon the Torah, they had drashot, that they were literally creating law that didn't previously exist, that was not already known. That the rabbis are being mechadesh, they're innovators. Whereas in Germany, they say, no, it was all from an older revelation and the rabbis are just playing with mnemonic devices. Should that strike you as odd? Which one is the more frum approach?
Didn't they get it from scraps and rocks and things that was written on it?
I don't know. So let me try to explain. Superficially, the more traditional approach would be to say it was all one massive revelation and the rabbis invented nothing. And the more progressive approach is to say that the rabbis interpreted verses of the Bible and created what they would call halachot d'oraita, Torah-based laws. Okay, and yet, really the opposite is true. The Lithuanians were not dealing with reformers, were not dealing with Wellhausens, Gentile scoffers. They were in a world of their own. Olama shel Torah, a world of the Torah. Yeah, there were some communists, okay, but they don't count. The Bundists and the Jewish atheists. But basically, when it came to religion, there was old world yeshiva religion and there was nothing else. So they could afford to not have to worry about people being curious of an evolution in the halakha. They didn't worry about that. And the tradition of the yeshiva, of the Lithuanian yeshiva, was that you had to be a Baal Machadesh. You had to come up with something new. That there was pilpul, there was amela shel Torah, serious delving work in the Torah. And the rabbis, the sages, are the masters of the text. And they control the destiny of the text. Okay? Whereas in Germany, that would be like a bridge too far. Because what are the rabbis, the Orthodox rabbis in Germany trying to accomplish? They're trying to create traditional balabatim, householders who at best will keep the halacha. They'll be shomer Shabbos. But as for deep study of Torah, forget about it. It ain't going to happen. So the German Orthodox, they can't say that the Tanaim and Amoraim invented halachot. That sounds reform. What can they say? They can say that the Torah as we have it, the halakha as we have it, comes from God on a mountaintop in the Sinai desert from a billion years ago, and it never changed, not even once. And therefore, the reformers in the middle of the roaders who are changing Judaism are wrong, and we're right. That's why they have this intellectual difference. Intellectual difference represents a major sociological difference and different in the ways of study. That Torah study was intense in the East, was not nearly so in the West. And so the West could not make claims about creative rabbis. All they could do was hold on to barely preserve that which they got from the past.
In practice, was there a difference?